Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host today, Kay Puttock, and hello to you, the listener. Today, we're featuring a special Pledge Drive edition of Local Talk, my interview with the writer, researcher, and social justice campaigner Chuck Collins. Chuck Collins, who's the great-grandson of the meat packer Oscar Mayer, is a member of the wealthiest 1% of people in this country. But he's also a multimillionaire who believes in progressive taxation, and he's the inheritor of a great fortune who believes in the estate tax, sometimes called the death tax. And Chuck Collins knows many other wealthy people who believe as he does, and he's convinced that many more can be converted to his way of thinking if they're approached in the right way. And that's partly the reason Chuck was in Iowa recently, where he was leading forums on economic justice in Des Moines, Coralville, and Iowa City. He was also promoting his latest and most personal book, Born on the Third Base, a one-percenter makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. And we'll get on to this exciting interview in just a minute or two. But today is KHOI's Fall Pledge Drive, and KHOI Radio is just the type of cause that my interview guest, Chuck Collins, believes in. Chuck Collins is a member of the wealthiest 1% of people in this country, and he's written many books talking about the necessity for wealthy people to pay their fair share of taxes, to pay estate taxes, and so on. But more to the point today, he believes in investing your money and your energy in your own community, in good causes where you live. And KHOI absolutely fits that bill. KHOI is a full power, fully functioning, volunteer-powered community radio station that broadcasts 24/7 to Central Iowa from the heart of downtown Ames. Our programs are about connecting you more meaningfully to your neighbors and to the world. From storytelling to music, from local news and events to national and international news, a day on KHOI's airwaves is as diverse as the community we serve. You're always welcome to stop by the station so that we can offer you a peek at the magic of community radio. Many people have stopped by and they've stayed to volunteer. We're thrilled that KHOI has entered its fifth year, transitioning from the building phase thanks to many hardworking volunteers to realizing its potential as independent media. The timing is good, with a wide spectrum of needs and viewpoints having surfaced during this election year and escalation of global questions. We ask you now to invest in your community radio station. Continue to support our efforts to keep community radio broadcasting in the heart of Iowa. Please respond to our pledge drive. Call 515-292-2878. Return the pledge envelope that you'll be receiving in the mail if you haven't already received it, or pledge at khoifm.org online, or just stop by our station, 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames, and donate in person. Remember, we're tax deductible. Please get in your pledges as generously as you can. This is the kind of community service, community organization, community building thing that you should be involved in. We look forward to meeting you if you come by the station. We always look forward to meeting you. Again, come and see us at the station at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames, or call 515-292-2878. Return your pledge envelope in the mail or pledge online at khoifm.org. And thank you. Now let's get back to the interview, or let's start the interview with Chuck Collins. I was able to interview Chuck about his ideas and his latest book at the home of a friend in Ames, where he was staying. Well, Chuck, we're here to talk about your latest book, Born on Third Base, the full title of which is A 1% Makes the Case for Tackling Inequality, Bringing Wealth Home, and Committing to the Common Good. And I didn't understand the title, first of all, but there's a quotation further on in the book which explains it. Some people are born on third base and go through life thinking they hit a triple. Now, could you start by telling us how you, as a person who was born on third base, decided at the age of 26 to give away your wealth? Could you explain that process?
Sure, and I realize the born on third base thing is a little bit of a baseball sports bias to it. But, you know, when I was 26, I had inherited a fairly substantial amount of money. My parents had created a trust fund for me. And the simple answer is I really didn't feel I needed it. I feel like I'd been given this tremendous head start. I saw all kinds of uses for the money that were more useful, and I really wanted to sort of move it on. It was kind of an impediment to my finding my own way in the world. You know, and at the time I was working with mobile home tenants, I was working with low-income tenants, so I was seeing the great inequalities between my own circumstances and other people's, and that was kind of an additional impetus.
Yeah, it's a very interesting story, actually, that you tell about your work with mobile home tenants. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, you know, it's my first real job, and I was really helping these residents of mobile home parks, mostly in New England, you know, Vermont, New Hampshire, Massachusetts. Their parks were coming up for sale, and I was working with them to be able to buy the parks themselves and own them as cooperatives. And in the process, I sort of did all the financial analysis to see if they could buy the park. And so I got to know everybody's very most intimate financial secrets. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, I sort of had this secret, which is I had this inheritance. It's not like I was telling anybody. And I think there was one moment and one story that I tell in the book where I really felt very acutely the gap between me, and I saw that these residents were struggling. And frankly, I had four or five times more money than all the people in this park at the age of 26. And there was no myth or story or justification in my mind that could make that work. So I think it was kind of an acute moment for me.
Now, you already mentioned that you thought your wealth was getting in the way. And you do say this early on in the book, and you use the term disconnection. Wealthy people get disconnected from the larger community. And this doesn't become absolutely clear what exactly you mean by that until you get close to the end of the book. And then you tell the stories of various people who have, like you, given away their wealth or in other ways, or at least agree with the kind of sentiments that you express in this book, that the system is rigged and is unfair. And you talk about how they changed and what they gained from changing, what they gained personally. They gave away their money because their money, as you put it, was getting in their way of their you might say, spiritual development or their happiness. Mm-hmm. Could you say more about that?
Well, I think part of it, when I talk about disconnection, I'm talking about growing up also in a kind of affluent bubble, a white affluent bubble, where I didn't have relationships with people who were very, very different. And then there's a way in which I think wealth buffers people and is sort of like, I call it a disconnection drug. It keeps you from connecting and empathizing with other people's circumstances. And even the basketball player Michael Jordan, in his own sort of autobiography, talks about as he grows more and more wealthy, his world got smaller and smaller. The number of real relationships that he could depend on got smaller, and he became more fearful that other people were out to sort of get his money.
Exactly.
So, you know, I see that a lot, and I experience that a lot, and I think it's not a terminal condition. It's a function of actually the wealth itself, and that if you want to be in authentic relationship with other people, you kind of have to show up with your needs, with your real vulnerability. And if you never are in that circumstance where you have to ask somebody for help, where you are essentially paying for the help, you miss out on a huge part of the human experience.
Yes, and this is something you get into when you're talking about community organizing and the creating resilient communities. Could you say more about that?
Well, yeah, and actually after the economic meltdown in 2008, as part of the church that I went to, people formed these small support groups, kind of mutual aid support groups, to help each other, kind of hold each other through the upheaval, insecurity of the time. And it was a powerful moment, I think, even people who are sort of middle class, thinking of themselves as self-sufficient and independent, all of a sudden discovered that they needed one another, that for their economic circumstances had changed, or they lost their job, or they lost their health care. And even these, I noticed some affluent folks joining these resilient circles because even though they had a cushion of money, they didn't have the personal networks, the social networks, mm-hmm. that they were feeling isolated themselves, and that they saw that this was a moment when people were actually connecting and coming together, and they didn't want to miss out on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people often do observe that poorer communities are closer to one another and have a more cooperative attitude with one another because they need to, I suppose. But it is something that people who are more well-to-do miss often. You tend to think you can buy whatever you need instead of exchanging favors with your neighbors and so on.
Yeah, I've noticed, and again, I've interviewed, dozens, hundreds of people about, the experience of wealth. And, there's both a loneliness, there's a sense of disconnection. And a lot of people describe the sensation of sort of like being the kid outside the window of an ice cream parlor looking in, and there's like a birthday party going on and they're not part of it. That's what I mean by disconnect that mm-hmm. people experience.
Yes, and one of the stories you tell is of a couple that said that they're quite well to do, but to join this neighborhood sharing group, and said, well, we get tired of parties that are just about, or gatherings that are just about food and talking about our latest vacation.
Yeah, there's a sort of hollowness. I quote a guy, Charles Eisenstein, who says, you can't have authentic community without vulnerability. Mm. And for a lot of affluent people, community is co-consumption. It's people getting together and, let's go out to this restaurant, let's go on this trip, let's see this place, let's consume, consume, consume. There is more actually to human life than that. And often it has to do with, connection and celebration and shared needs, and helping each other meet each other's needs. So, and again, you see that, as you were saying, in lower-income communities, in new immigrant communities where people, again, need to depend on each other, you'll find more of that, both interconnection, sometimes expression, people are dealing with each other's loss and suffering, but also deep, deep joy and celebration.
We will get on to talking about the change, the things that you point out on a larger level, government level and so on, which seems so very relevant at this time in this country, and especially during the election season and what we're seeing here. But before we get on to that, could you tell us some of the stories that you detail at the end of the book, people who, how did you put it? Open their hearts or?
Oh, yeah. Tell probably a dozen stories of people who I describe as bringing their wealth home in different ways.
What I mean by, and
I think part of what I write in this book is to invite the wealthy home. Bring your wealth out of the offshore tax havens, out of the global financial casino, out of the fossil fuel sector, and bring it home to the real economy. Invest it in your region where you live, in real goods and services and businesses. And also bringing wealth home is sharing the wealth, paying one's fair share of taxes, telling true stories about the origins of wealth. And, there's a lot of, to me, people who are kind of exemplars of that. There's a man, Daryl Garner, I tell his story. He's probably one of the wealthiest food, had the second largest.
They call him a millionaire Buddha, I believe.
Yeah, well, actually, there's a novel about him called The Billionaire Buddha, written by his partner, Rivera Sun. But he probably had hundreds of millions of dollars. He was the second biggest food exporter from Mexico, exporting agricultural crops into the U.S. for the Southern California sort of food market. And then he went on to develop a number of resorts. He was, a very serial entrepreneur, very successful. But he sort of had a kind of a crisis of meaning and faith. And, at a certain point, he just decided that he wanted to rejoin humanity in a sense, and he gave away, tens of millions of dollars over a couple of years and essentially gave away almost all the wealth he has. He now lives on his Social Security income. and lives a very simple life. And he says he's never been happier. He found that having that kind of wealth not only distanced himself, but also kind of made him have to depend on the extraction of wealth from other people and from nature and the community. So, you know, he's a sort of living testament to happiness. There's another woman story I tell named Jenny Ladd, who, you know, again, was an heiress to the Standard Oil fortune, has given away substantial amounts of her wealth, lives in a kind of working class community in a small town in New England, is kind of involved and plugged in, but is very webbed into her community. I tell the story of sort of how she's really kind of grounded and rooted in a place and is in very involved in fixing that place and making it a great community. Mm-hmm. There's another woman I know who that I described, Deborah Fries, who uses her wealth to create an impact investment fund that provides loans to startup businesses, primarily in communities of color, providing low interest or zero interest loans, and sort of the role of capital, of how could you use capital and bring it home to a place and really make an impact.
Yeah, maybe we should say just a bit more about impact investing.
Well, you know, I think of these as, in Deborah's words, this is going off the Wall Street grid. It's meaning you're taking your money out of the securities, Wall Street economy, and actually doing direct lending, you know, kind of venture capital, but also low interest loans or even zero interest loans and grants to support businesses. So there's a very exciting kind of startup waste management company in Boston. And she was really the early venture capital in that the risk capital that has allowed them to grow and succeed.
One of the things you deal with very early in the book is the whole concept of class war. I mean, this sort of loaded term, class war. Because as soon as people try to start talking about sharing the wealth and so on, this term class war comes up. And you sort of deal with this. And also, you stress very early on that it's important not to do what you call rich bashing. And you do talk about what you mean by wealthy. There's so many different degrees of wealth. And people at a certain level are more susceptible to this talk. If they're still feeling insecure themselves, they're less susceptible to this kind of thinking. But you do talk a lot about wealth bashing and approaching wealthy people in the right way.
Right. Well, I, first off, you know, people talk about class war, and I like to say, as Warren Buffett said, there is a class war in America, but my class is winning, meaning that there is a wealthy class.
It's my class that's making war, and we're winning.
And I think it's an important statement because what I've noticed in the last 20 years of working on these issues of extreme inequality in America is if you just sort of point out the simple fact that the 1% has captured huge amounts of the income and wealth of the last couple decades, people say, oh, you're fomenting class war, or you're encouraging resentment to the top.
Or envy politics.
Yeah, the politics of envy or whatever. And, you know, I would just say, you know, time out here. We're just describing the reality. You know, we've become a considerably more unequal society. But part of my message is when people sort of then lump all wealthy people together and sort of feel a sort of resentment and anger and kind of bash wealthy people as a whole group, all I would say is, you know, I understand that. I feel those feelings myself. You know, I see people come along and they buy a prescription drug and then jack up the price 5,000%. I mean, that's appalling, right? But what I would just say is we have all these potential allies in the room, that the rich are not monolithic.
Yeah, and you talk about putting compassionate pressure on the wealthy.
I think there is a segment of the wealthy that use their wealth and power to rig the rules and foment the, well, you know, kind of class war toward others. So there's a segment. But it is a small, well-organized, resourced group. And then there's like the networks that I'm part of, like the Patriotic Millionaires, Wealth for the Common Good, the Resource Generation Group. These are groups that are affluent, wealthy business leaders, people like me born on third base, who use their wealth to kind of try to build a more fair and just system. And then there's this large segment of people who are wealthy but are just disconnected. They're disengaged, just like most of society. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So my point is, let's engage. Let's not assume everybody's on our enemy, and actually figure out ways to engage and invite home some of these wealthy folks to bring their wealth and their whole stake back to a place. So I'm part of this book is coaching. You know, I do a section called The Roadmap to Richistan, which is to just sort of explain who are the wealthy and how they're segmented in different ways. And part of that's to say, you know, let's get smarter about how we think about inequality and where we might find potential allies in right. changing that.
Actually, I've got a quote here that is maybe relevant. These are your words. I know hundreds of people who are very wealthy and deeply disconnected. Many of them hunger for real and heartfelt community. They find the social gatherings centered on food, entertainment, and talking about their latest vacation to be vapid and unsatisfying.
Yeah, and I would add to that many wealthy people feel the overall insecurity of what it's like to live in the United States. That you know, I think we underestimate just how stressful it is to live in a society where you're one job loss, one divorce, one major illness away from a very precarious or destitute life. And it doesn't have to be that way. I mean, people in the Nordic countries and Canada have a fundamental safety net that right. they don't...
Yeah, I feel that a lot, actually, because I grew up, well, I was abroad a lot, but basically in England. And with all the faults of the national health system, you know, there is a basic security there.
Yeah.
Which there isn't in this country, really.
Yeah, and I think that on some level, wealthy people know that, and that they therefore feel that insecurity, and the corollary as well, and we need to hoard and build up mountains of money around ourselves, and then we need to build mountains of money around our children, and we still feel insecure, you know, mm-hmm. because it's chronic to the system. So I say that because if we create together a more secure system for all people, if we create a safety net, I think the wealthy won't hold on as tight. I think that partly, you know, and in the Nordic countries, people don't feel the same resentment around taxes because part of what they're paying for is a level of security and stress reduction of just knowing that there'll be a net there. Mm-hmm. Instead of creating sort of privatized family security, we're all better off if there's some level of minimal security in the society as a whole.
This is KHOI Community Radio. And I'm talking to Chuck Collins, who's the great-grandson of the meatpacker Oscar Mayer, and who's just written one of many books, Born on Third Base, where he explains that as a person born on third base, he doesn't need to hit a triple. We're talking about why he believes in progressive taxation and sharing the wealth. But today is KHOI's Fall Pledge Drive, and KHOI Radio is just the type of cause that my interview guest, Chuck Collins, believes in. Chuck Collins is a member of the wealthiest 1% of people in this country, and he's written many books talking about the necessity for wealthy people to pay their fair share of taxes, to pay estate taxes, and so on. But more to the point today, he believes in investing your money and your energy in your own community, in good causes where you live. And KHOI absolutely fits that bill. Our programs are about connecting you more meaningfully to your neighbors and to the world. You're always welcome to stop by the station so that we can offer you a peek at the magic of community radio. People have stopped by and they've stayed to volunteer. We're thrilled that KHOI has entered its fifth year, transitioning from the building phase, thanks to many hardworking volunteers, to realizing its potential as independent media. We ask you now to invest in your community radio station. Continue to support our efforts to keep community radio broadcasting in the heart of Iowa. Please respond to our pledge drive. Call 515-292-2878. Return the pledge envelope that you'll be receiving in the mail if you haven't already received it, or pledge at khoifm.org online, or just stop by our station, 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames, and donate in person. Remember, we're tax deductible. Please get in your pledges as generously as you can. This is the kind of community service community organization, community building that you should be involved in. We look forward to meeting you if you come by the station. We always look forward to meeting you. Again, come and see us at the station at 410 Douglas in downtown Ames or call 515-292-2878. Return your pledge envelope in the mail or pledge online at khoifm.org. And thank you. Now let's get back to the interview with Chuck Collins. Talking about privatized security, you do talk also about why we shouldn't maybe send our children to private schools or private swimming pools, but use the local ones. And you do tell a lovely story about your community swimming pool in Jamaica Plain.
Yeah, and my point is that wealthy people have kind of unplugged or withdrawn from much of the civic sphere. And so they've taken not only their tax dollars, but they've taken their stake in the system working. And I mean by that is the education system, the recreation system, the transportation system. You know, wealthy people have privatized all those needs. They, you know, kids go to private school. They, you know, have access to private transportation. They go to their private clubs, et cetera. And part of what I'm urging people to do is put your stake back in the functioning of the systems that almost everyone else depends on. My kids went to the Boston Public Schools. What that meant is that I had a stake in making sure those schools were good. And it's not that if I sent them to private school, it's not that I wouldn't care. It's just that I wouldn't have any skin in the game. I wouldn't have any stake there, and I would forget about that, you know, because I don't have a stake in it. And same with my neighborhood pool. We had a public pool. I used to take my daughter there for the family swim, and, you know, we would show up, and there would be a scheduling screw-up and no lifeguard, and this happened several times to the point where I realized, you know, maybe I'm going to become the squeaky wheel here, mm-hmm. use the sort of social capital, the sense of agency and privilege that I have to really hunt this down and make the system work for me. Because I was maybe one of the few white parents who were affected, but I was looking at 20 other parents of color. Now, they could have also gotten
20, as you say, 20 parents with their kids in bathing suits, wet because they just come out of the shower before they go into the pool, and then they can't swim because there's no lifeguard.
Yeah,
and this happens often.
Yeah, and so I was, you know, but I thought, well, I know how to fix this. You know, it's just a matter of time. You know, I know who to call. I know who to bother. I know who, you know, I can use my connections, if you will. And that's what, you know, and one of the things that wealthy people have often is a sense of agency that comes from being in a multi-generational family where you've got folks who are used to pulling strings and using their power. So instead of I'm not pulling my string to get my kid into a private school, I'm pulling my string to get a lifeguard at the public pool. Mm-hmm. So that's just an example to me, but I think it's part of what it means for the wealthy to come home is have a stake in everything that everyone else depends on.
We've been talking about these motivations of the wealthy people themselves. We haven't talked much about people that vote to continue these policies and the politicians that work to enforce them. Now, do you think some people really believe in trickle-down economics?
I actually think that some people are not cynical. They actually think that this is going to be the solution to poverty, that we're going to somehow cut taxes on the wealthy, we're going to stimulate investment, and that investment, that capital will go and create enterprises that will employ people. It's a fundamentally flawed theory, but I don't think it's all bad intention, mm-hmm. meaning that people have very powerful ideologies and theories that they're holding on to. I think they're wrong, but they're holding on to them. So part of it, again, is, you know, it's not always cynical. It's not always like people who think, you know, read Ayn Rand. They actually might be thinking this is the best way to help people who are poor.
And there's various mythologies that you talk about that in our culture about wealth creation that many people believe and that, in a sense, our whole culture believes and that is reinforced by the media. One of them being the mythology of deservedness. I did it alone. Yeah. I made this money myself, the self-made person, the self-made man or woman. I did it myself. I pulled myself up by my bootstraps. And you spend a lot of time showing what a myth this is.
Yeah, I think it's actually one of the most powerful stories that we tell that in a way, I think, reinforces these inequalities. You know, you and I could tell you the data, the statistics about inequality, and you might be shocked or concerned, or it might motivate you to action. But a lot of people hear that and they think, oh, that's because wealthy people work harder and they apply themselves and they've taken risks. And the reason why other people are poor or excluded from the economy is they're not as smart or they don't work as hard. So that the fundamental explanation for inequality is it's an inequality of deservedness.
Yeah, well, in the first generation, of course, of wealthy people, they probably do work very hard.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things.
Well, there's no probably about it. They do.
And I think that there's, there's an important recognition that individual effort does matter. But it doesn't explain the kind of grotesque inequalities in the society we're living in now. So people take the sort of the story of here's, you know, Uncle Frank, who's the slacker, and Aunt Rita, who's the go-getter, and they kind of project that onto these economic statistics. That does not explain why the wealthiest 1% has, you know, almost 40% of all the private wealth, and why most of the income and wealth gains of the last 10 years have gone to the top 0.1%. It's not that those people are working any harder. No. It's there are these structural inequalities.
Right. Once you've made a million, it just makes itself after that.
Yeah, as Edgar Bronfman says, you know, making the first $100 is significant, but going from 100 million to 110 million is inevitable. And part of the way to disrupt those stories, and I try to do this in Born on Third Base, is tell the stories of wealthy entrepreneurs who recognize that their wealth came not just through their own effort, but from being, doing business in a country that's created a fertile ground for wealth creation with public investments and all kinds of supports, as well as a sort of wealth defense industry that swoops in now. Once you've started growing your wealth, there's a whole industry of accountants and trust attorneys and the like who help you shelter your wealth and hide it and protect.
Right. And this maybe brings us to the topic of estate taxes, which some people like to call death taxes. And you've written a book defending that. Well, you teamed up with Bill Gates Sr. to write Wealth and Our Commonwealth, Why America Should Tax Accumulated Fortunes. And would you like to talk about that? Why should anyone pay estate tax?
If you had $11 million or more, then you would start to pay an estate tax in today's economy. I think it's a great issue, both because how are we going to address this great concentration of wealth and power? One of the ways we have to do that is through taxing accumulated wealth, taxing inheritances to slow down this buildup of these wealth dynasties. But it's also an issue that people have a lot of strong feelings about and a lot of confusion and misinformation about. And I think it goes to the heart of that myth that we're talking about. You know, people say, oh, why are you taxing the wealthy? You're punishing success and you're double taxing the wealthy. And I come back and say, well, you know, if you have $10 million or $20 million or $50 billion in the society, you didn't do it alone. It's a function in part of this society and these institutions and public investments that we've done together. And if you should be so fortunate that you have that kind of wealth, then a portion of that should go back to the investments, back to the society that made that wealth possible, so that other people who are not born rich can have the same opportunities. So wealth taxation is a form of economic opportunity recycling, is how I think of it.
Right, yeah. You talk about a story that Bill Gates Sr. told that showed very graphically the fairness of estate taxes.
Yeah, one of the things is, you know, I got to write this book with Bill Gates Sr., the father of the founder of Microsoft, and he was very, very eloquent. He would sort of go out and talk in public and explain to people, you know, if you have that kind of wealth, you probably worked hard, but you didn't do it alone. No one does it alone. Let's look at the matrix of all the supports that help make individual wealth creation possible. Property rights protections, public investments in research, higher education, all, you know, he would sort of expose the whole web, and people would sort of hear it from him, because here was the father of the most wealthy person on the planet, at least at the time, saying, no one does it alone. Even my son, Bill Jr., you know, he didn't do it alone. he's operating in a society that makes his wealth creation possible. And without that society, he's not so wealthy. And so it's just sort of a simple statement of reality.
Yeah, so even using public libraries, as you say, all the research is out there, a lot of it publicly funded and so on, without things that most people agree should spend on, like defense and so on. Although that's also what people worry about wasting tax money on.
I mean, I would say that there's a commonwealth. You know, we have our individual private wealth, but then around us is this commonwealth, including the ecological bounty, the fact that we live on this abundant planet that provides for so much of what we need. But we have these things that we've built together, the internet, the library systems, systems of knowledge and language, scientific research. All of these things are kind of like foundational. And then along comes Mark Zuckerberg, and he builds a little bit on top of this.
Like the cherry on the sundae, as you say.
Yeah, it's sort of like I like to say he put the cherry on the top of the sundae, but gets to claim ownership of the whole ice cream parlor. The ice cream parlor is the commonwealth, and no individual should take from the commonwealth.
So, yeah, because we're all building this together, really. I mean, it's the heritage of generations. We're all standing on one another's shoulders.
Yeah, and the obligation of wealthy people is to continue to add to that foundation, you know, not to take away from it or not to pretend, oh, I did it on my own, and who cares about the next generation? So it's in part a generational or legacy perspective that is sometimes missing in our society. I want to give back, not just through my private charity, but I want to give back so that the public infrastructure and institutions will still be here for the next generation.
And what could be a more appropriate place than to interrupt and ask for your pledge dollars? If you believe in what Chuck was just saying about making sure that our public institutions, our public services, and everything we rely on is here for the next generation, you should invest in KHOI now during our fall pledge drive. We're thrilled that KHOI has now entered its fifth year, moving on from its building phase, thanks to many, many hardworking volunteers, and now is beginning to realize its potential as an independent medium for you, for the local community, to build community, for you to listen to your neighbors. And we want to make sure that it does continue for the next generation and many more generations to come. We need to move on from the building phase to making KHOI really secure. Please respond to our pledge drive. Call 292-2878. Return the pledge envelope or pledge online at khoifm.org. Or stop by the studios at 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames and donate in person. We're always delighted to see you. And now let's get back to my interview with Chuck Collins, author of Born on Third Base. A 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. Now, as you point out, when you think about trying to get people to think more deeply about this, part of the problem is that two separate things are sort of confused, or two separate fights. One is, what do people do with the tax money? Do they waste it?
Right.
And the other is whether we should pay into taxes. Now, again, as I say, I was brought up in Britain. And I didn't hear people complaining about taxes because they felt they got something for it.
Yeah, and I would say that's true in the Nordic countries. Wealthy people pay very high taxes, but they also, their children go to college without debt, and they have access to high-quality health insurance, and they know that there's a safety net there, and they know that there are public goods that they support. I think the pickle in the United States is, as you alluded to, we waste a huge amount of money because we have this powerful defense industry, and we have a powerful energy lobby as well that force us to pay money for things that are not necessary, you know, really aren't going to make us more secure. So our spending, our government priorities are kind of warped by powerful corporations and the interests of the wealthy. So sometimes people say, well, I don't want to pay taxes because it's going to go to that wasteful system. and I'm trying to make a distinction, which is we should have a system of revenue, regardless of what we decide to use the money for. We should have a progressive system of revenue where those who benefit disproportionately from the benefits of living in the society, the very wealthy, pay back or pay a progressive portion of their income and assets to pay for whatever it is we decide. Then on the other hand, there's the whole discussion of, well, what do we use the money for? And how do we come together and do that? And in a society like ours right now, where we're barely living in a democracy, it's a pretty
strong statement.
Yeah, living in an oligarchy controlled by large fossil fuel corporations and military contractors, it's
hard
to say.
And Big Pharma, maybe.
Maybe Big Pharma, and these companies have too much power, and they're warping our priorities. But that's another fight. That's another arena of, that we need to be engaged in. So I would say we need to have both a fair revenue system and a better system of allocating what it is we spend our money on.
Now, there were some things in this that really opened my eyes that I really didn't know much about and are very relevant, again, to our current political scene. And that is so-called charitable foundations, which are, in fact, charities for the people that start them very often. And for example, family vacations at exotic resorts, which they call board meetings.
Yeah, I mean, I should say that most of what people call philanthropy is probably very, very good. And a lot of the money goes to support a vibrant independent sector, of nonprofit organizations and community arts organizations and the like. So we're fortunate to live in a society where we have that independent sector. That said, more and more very wealthy families are using foundations kind of as an extension of their own personal power. They're using, they're creating family foundations. They're taking money out of the realm of taxation, putting it in a charitable institution, and then using those funds for very narrow purposes.
In fact, during the presidential debates, when they got onto the topic of foundations, in fact, it was Trump that brought this up, although there all had been recently the scandals about his foundation. And he went into a diatribe about what Hillary Clinton was allegedly doing with the Clinton Foundation. And I immediately thought, well, he seems to know a lot about all the corruption in this arena. It takes one to know one.
Yeah. Well, I think both the Clinton Foundation and the Trump Foundation are a good example of why we should fundamentally reform charitable giving and foundation laws, because these are foundations that are largely serving their private personal agendas. The Clinton Foundation, I'm sure, has moved, billions to useful projects overseas, and I don't know entirely about the Trump Foundation. But there are lots of examples of foundations where the principal beneficiaries are still the families that create them.
Well, they pay the board members who are family members, and they give away very small. They try to preserve the foundation forever. They're not dispersing it into charities, but they're funding so-called board meetings, which are, in fact, family vacations.
Yeah, and I tell some very personal firsthand examples of the abuses that are possible with this private foundation system and how some private charity now is worsening inequality. So the original purpose of the charitable foundations was people could give money, they get a tax break because they're actually doing something useful and of a broader public interest and public good, and that's the justification for it. And if they're using overhead to give their children jobs or to pay for board meetings in very exotic locations, they're really not protecting the public trust. So I make the case that these charitable foundations, if people want to give money away but not take a deduction, it's their money. They can do what they want. But if they want the rest of us taxpayers to bless their gift and essentially chip in 40 to 50 cents on every dollar that they give, then we have a public stake and a right to know, is this the best use of taxpayer money and the public treasury? So there's a lot of, I think, unfortunate abuses in that area, and there's a lot of self-interested and self-dealing that happens. I make the case like these foundations should have independent boards. They should have not be able to use, spend so much on overhead and have that be considered a legitimate expense, on and on and on.
When you think of some of the great philanthropists in the past, like Carnegie and Rockefeller, what do you think of their investments, their charitable gifts, if you like?
I think that there's some great examples of very wealthy people doing good public works. I mean, Rockefeller invested in public health in the South in a way revolutionizing the public health system. The Carnegie Libraries, you know, all around the United States, you can see the libraries and institutions that were built with Carnegie donations. You know, one question is, were those funds, were they a way of avoiding taxation? Mm-hmm. And that's what I see is now every billionaire now is creating a foundation. They're moving huge amounts of money to the foundations. Even Bill Gates's dad once said to me, you know, isn't it a little weird that Bill can give $85 billion of wealth to a private foundation and will never have to pay any taxes on that wealth? So maybe we should have a cap mm-hmm. on the amount of money that can be given to charity and deducted over one's lifetime. Because, you know, charity is not a substitute for taxation. Tax dollars pay for infrastructure. They pay for big solutions to big problems. Charity is a lab funds an independent sector that's a very, very useful laboratory for innovation, et cetera, but it's not a substitute.
Yeah, and often charities, they go for art museums and things that people enjoy, certainly, but they give it to a museum with their name on the front or, and so on. I mean, it's wealthy people that enjoy these things more.
Yeah, and again, you know, if I wanted to, you know, give my money and have the Chuck Collins wing of the museum or of higher education, you know, that's partly my money to do that with. But is that the best, highest and best use of tax dollars at a time when we're experiencing more and more kind of government austerity and budget cuts?
You say at one point that the price of artworks is often artificially inflated for this reason, which makes sense when I'd never thought of that before. I mean, these paintings that have been around for years and years, and suddenly, you know, the price shoots up on, it's a tax dodge.
Yeah, so there's a lot of, like, tax dodge-oriented philanthropy.
On these artworks, the price is inflated because of this auction that was sort of rigged, and then they donate this painting, that is the price of which has been artificially inflated, to a museum and take a gigantic tax cut because of that.
Yeah. I mean, I actually confidentially interviewed a couple of people who worked in these museums who described, so there's a lot of abuse when wealthy people own appreciated assets. They bought a painting, they bought a piece of land, and now they want to give that appreciated asset to charity. And so they do everything they can to make it as expensive of an asset as possible. So it's as if you and I, let's say you and I both own a painting, and we go to the auction and each bid up each other's painting cost, so we establish a new basis for that gift. Then we give it to the museum, and we take this huge tax break. We basically reduce our taxes or eliminate our taxes for several years to come because of the size of this gift. That's the same thing with appreciated land value.
Right. People just creating private land, calling it a nature conservancy around their own homes.
Yeah. And again, there's a vibrant land trust movement that does great work, so I'm not disparaging that. But there are these closely held little land trust conservancy trusts where people basically create a private buffer zone around their property, give it to this trust, take their property off the tax rolls, and get a charitable deduction.
And often the public aren't allowed there anyway.
Yeah, they may or may not have any kind of public access or even public benefit, really, other than help me protect my view. So is that a good use of tax dollars? Is that a good use of the public treasury? No, it's actually a scandal. Here, the problem is there's very little oversight and accountability. You know, the Council of Foundations, the lobby that protects foundations, basically their message is, leave us alone, we know better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I don't think you talk about this in your book, but the vast sums that are now spent on elections, I can't help thinking, you know, what really good things could be done with all that money?
No, we are, you know, I mean, in the first half of this presidential election cycle, half the money came from 158 donors. We're probably looking at another, you know, couple $1 billion of funds that have been spent both in the formal election system as well as in the sort of shadow dark money influencing election system. You know, most of that goes to the big media corporations for their television time. Actually, the chairman of CBS was just quoted saying, oh, it's been a great year for us. You know, we're making billions. It's a great year for us, but a bad year for democracy. He said the influence of Donald Trump has been just fabulously lucrative for the media companies, but maybe not so good for democracy. So, you know, part of our work is to, you know, we need to basically turn off, pull the plug on these big corporate media that make money from fostering divisions among us.
Maybe we should end on an up note.
Well, I think that the good news is we're going through a political realignment. You know, people are waking up to these inequalities. They see that they are not good for anybody. And my message, part of the message to this book is to the 1% is these extreme inequalities of wealth are bad for everybody, including the very wealthy. We do not want to live in a society with this kind of polarization of wealth. We don't want our children and grandchildren and nieces and nephews to have to live in this kind of economic apartheid society. And I think people are waking up. I think the Bernie Sanders movement, I think even, you know, the sort of sense of awakening and betrayal of some of the supporters of the Donald Trump candidacy. These are basically, it's a democratic impulse. It's recognizing that, you know, as people say, the game is rigged. The economy has been rigged to funnel wealth to the top. The rules are tilted in favor of the very wealthy. And we're not going to put up with it anymore. So there's a huge pressure building for some kind of realignment. And I'm very hopeful that that would lead us toward moving more toward a democratic, healthy capitalism. You know, people say, you know, when people are interviewed, what kind of society do you want to live in? What they describe is something like Sweden, where there's a basic minimal safety net, where there aren't these grotesque inequalities of wealth, where their wealthy pay their fair share, where working a full-time job is enough to have you earn enough money to have a good life. That's the kind of society people want to have. And it's fully in our grasp. I mean, we, after World War II, organized our society to encourage the expansion of a middle class and stability for working class people. Right. And we can reprioritize.
Yeah, people want to spend more time with their families. And if entrepreneurs, first generation entrepreneurs work very hard, a lot of poor people work very hard at three jobs too.
That's right. I mean, here's the reality. The rate of entrepreneurship in the Nordic countries is much faster and it's a higher rate than the United States per capita because people feel they can take risks because they're not going to become destitute. So it's not just the wealthy who get to be venture capitalists and entrepreneurs, but it's more healthy if the other people in the society have the basic safety net that enables people to do that. So I don't think all of us are going to become entrepreneurs, but if that's something that's important, we can reward that, you know, and we can certainly create the security that allows people to take those leaps and those risks.
Well, thank you very much, Chuck Collins. Talking of bringing wealth home, how about committing to your public radio station, KHOI? This is our pledge drive, and we ask you, as a supporter of KHOI, to continue to support our efforts to keep community radio broadcasting in the heart of Iowa. Please respond to our pledge drive by calling 515-292-2878. That's one way to make a pledge. Or you can return the pledge envelope or pledge online at khoifm.org. Or stop by our studio at 410 Douglas Avenue in Ames to donate in person. Remember, all your contributions are tax deductible. We always look forward to meeting you at the station. And please show that you believe in the kinds of things that Chuck Collins has been talking about in this interview and send us those pledges, khoifm.org, or call us 292-2878. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I've been your host, Kay Puttock. Today I featured a special interview with Chuck Collins, a member of the wealthiest 1% of people in this country, and the author of many books, including the one that was the main subject of today's program, a book called Born on Third Base, a 1%er makes the case for tackling inequality, bringing wealth home, and committing to the common good. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host, Kay Puttock, and we'll see you again on the radio.